Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife and maybe wildlife elsewhere as well with our guest today, Scott Craven. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. Scott's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist, and we can talk about the latest news on bird migration, the breeding season, turkeys, of course, and maybe starting your spring garden with wildlife in mind. Join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, it's great to be back, Larry. It's nice to be in this beautiful studio. Everything just seems so screwy trying to get back to normal with some things. We had one of our big hunting awareness classes in Chicago last week. First time in 3 years we've been together in that venue, and it was like getting the band back together. It was unusually fun and productive, and it's great to be back doing things again.
Well, the spring turkey hunt, which I don't think did the hunt ever stop at all during COVID? Because
no,
I didn't think so. Because that's a solitary kind of thing for the most part, and.
Well, that was that and all pretty much all forms of outdoor recreation, from park visitations and camping, all enjoyed a spike in participation because of COVID or in response to COVID. And that spike has subsided a little bit on some fronts. But nevertheless, there were plenty of people turkey hunting over the past few years, and there are still plenty of turkeys out there, despite some concern that maybe there aren't quite as many as there might have been a few years ago.
Yeah. Christopher in La Crescent, Minnesota's got a story for us about turkey. Let's go there. Hi, Christopher.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning. What's on your mind?
So I live on a ridge just across the river in Minnesota, and last May a tom showed up and started courting our chickens. We have a small flock. Well, we had a small flock. We only have one left because they're free range, and so the wildlife around here has taken their toll. And anyway, he showed up last May, and he courted. He was on full display. He followed them around. He herded them underneath the Burnham bush. Eventually, they got used to him, and he has stayed with us for a year now. He's still here, and he's still courting our one chicken. And I don't know if this, you know, we assumed he was some sort of hand-raised turkey, but I'm not sure that's the case. He survived, what, two hunting seasons now? He survived on the bird feed that fell out of our bird feeder. And I must admit, this winter, I threw out some cracked corn for him.
Well,
and he's still here. And one other thing I'd like to say is last year we never heard it. But this year, we hear what I understand is called a spit and drum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he didn't do that last year because when he's close like he would get, you can feel it. You don't just hear it. You feel it.
Yeah. You feel the vibration.
Yeah. Interesting. Christopher, thanks for calling. Comments, Scott?
Well, you know, over the years, we've heard of all sorts of strange interactions, like this rough grouse riding on people's shoulders while they're mowing the lawn, and whether this turkey decided that the food handouts and the safety and security of that yard, as well as the chickens to fool around with, seemed to make sense. I guess I was going to ask Christopher if he's not seen any other turkeys around there. There certainly should be some. There's lots of them along the Mississippi. So I would think that the turkey would have moved off with others of its own feathers, so to speak. But I can't offer up any solid explanation, except it's one of those curiosities, and Christopher and his family seem to have embraced it, and I don't think anybody's going to hold them with any ill will for perhaps pitching out a little corn to get the thing through the winter at the bird feeder. So
It's a great story.
As long as he hangs out there, it makes for a great story.
Yeah. Thanks, Christopher. A wonderful story. Oh, my goodness me. Well, Bill in Oregon has a comment as well.
Hi, Larry, Scott.
Hi.
Recently had a neighbor bring me out into his backyard at dusk, and we were enjoying the mating display, or what I believe to be the mating display of woodcocks.
Oh, cool.
And fortunately, they aren't available on my land, but I was surprised that they seem to be... well, I guess I was just curious, do they require a lot of brush and bushes around, or do they expand, or does that expand into just fields?
Well,
or what kind of areas do they do their displays, I guess?
Well, so the spring courtship display of a woodcock, which is a popular game bird, and it's also a shore bird, kind of a stocky little brown thing with long legs and a long beak that it uses to probe for worms, for folks perhaps not familiar with woodcock. But in any event, the males find a display ground, which is they're more interested in open space near the cover you described than the actual brush and trees, because they need an open space for the aerial display and a spot to come back down and land in. It's a neat thing to see. The sound they make is called peenting. It's kind of that nasal, something like that,
yeah,
that people become familiar with. And then there's a twittering sound made by the feathers in their wings as they swirl and dive and come back down to ground after. They'll peent and stomp around on the ground for a little bit to advertise their presence. It's a territorial thing and to attract mates. And then periodically they'll just zoom, go airborne, fly way up in the sky, as you've been witnessing, and then circle around a bit, circle around, and you can see them up there, and then they'll make this twittering sound as they quickly descend in spirals, and usually they'll land in the exact same spot they took off from. So if you're watching the display, every time they go airborne, you can cheat a little and creep a little closer. And I've even heard in the past of people who go out and, oh, he took off right there, and you know, put their hat on the ground or something, and zoom, the bird will come right back to it. So it's an interesting spring activity. And this brings back memories of my grad school days when the collective students in the wildlife program were dispatched to the Arboretum, which was divided up into a zone system. And every night we'd be responsible for a zone to determine how many woodcock were peenting there. And collectively over the years, this provided some pretty interesting trend information on how the woodcock population was doing. So anyway, the spring woodcock display, the mating dance, it's in Leopold's book. He talks about it. It's been well known for a long time. Starts to occur when the light gets to I forget whether it's 1, 2, 3 foot candles, something like that. But at a certain light intensity, they fly into their display area, then do their thing, and people enjoy watching it. So it'll go on for a little while yet. I'm glad you brought it up, because I was thinking about going to the Arboretum some evening to a spot that I used to survey 40, well, oh, God, it's longer than that. Never mind. A long time ago. And see if there were still some woodcock out there. So thanks for bringing it up, Bill.
Appreciate it, Bill. Louise in Dodgeville, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi, I have a question. So my husband and I actually were pondering this. So chickens, like farm chickens, lay and one egg typically daily. So wondering if wildlife do the same, and if not, why not?
Well, it's a matter of, so the interval of egg laying is around a day. For example, for a goose, it's about a day and a half. So it takes a mallard duck, for example, or a goose, a grouse, a pheasant, or whatever, the better part of a couple of weeks to lay a full clutch of eggs in their nest. But they're determinate layers, so that their clutch size is somewhat predetermined within a certain range of limits. So once the nest is complete, then it's time for them to get down to incubation, and there's no possibility or thought of, well, heck, this is working out pretty well, I'll just keep piling up the eggs. They can't do that physiologically. If the nest is lost to a predator or flooding or something like that, the female can restart the cycle and create a second nest, a re-nest as it's called, and maybe even do that a couple of times over the course of the summer. But a chicken, on the other hand, is programmed to just keep laying, and they do at that one-day interval. But the interval varies a little bit with the size of the bird, and again, most Most wild birds, unlike domestic chickens, are programmed to get a clutch complete and get down to the business of raising those chicks.
And, you know, next week, Louise, I hope you tune in next week on Wednesday, because, and anybody else for that matter, because Lizzie Stark will be on, and she wrote the book. It's titled Egg, simply Egg. And you would not believe the fascinating information about people and eggs and about the eggs themselves. And I've just started reading it, so I haven't finished it yet. But it is a fascinating book about eggs of all kinds. And the title of the book is Egg, and the author is Lizzie Stark, and she's on next week, Wednesday.
There you go. Timely, around Easter. There'll be eggs everywhere.
Ostrich eggs, those are the toughest eggs, I think. You could stand on an ostrich egg, and I could, and not break the shell.
An egg is a pretty interesting little biological package, so I may tune into that next week.
It's fascinating. Louise, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Chris in Black Creek, it's your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Larry. I hunted turkeys quite a bit through the years, and I've won competitions on making a gobble with my own voice. But before I do that, my question is, your guest almost answered the question, because I heard years back that a farm-raised pheasant that's planted in the wild doesn't reproduce. I don't know if that's true or not, so that's my question. But not only did I call in my own turkey, Tom's, right to my decoy with my own voice, but I'd also drum with my chest for fan-tailed ruffled grouse. but... Let's
hear it. Let's hear it. I may invite you to go hunting with me so I don't have to call.
All right. All you really have to do is just let your tongue waddle, shake your head, and exhale, and it goes like this.
Oh. And that is good.
That's pretty good. How about as long as you're on a roll? How about the drumming rough grouse?
Okay, here's the drumming rough grouse. What you do is you open your jacket, and you take your fist, and I got to put my mic down to my chest, and you pound on your chest like this.
Well, that's an interesting talent, Chris. I'm especially impressed with the gobble. But let me get back to your question for a second. You know, the notion that farm-raised birds will not reproduce or lay eggs in the wild is simply not
correct.
Not correct. I mean, since you mentioned pheasants, you know, remember that the pheasant is not a native species. So all pheasants in the United States right now, whether they're on game farms or running around in people's backyards or whatever,
North Dakota,
their ancestors came from Asia and were released here. And obviously then, as people have been producing them on game farms and so forth, they have propagated prolifically, and now we see pheasants across a huge range in the United States, and they've become a very popular game bird and, in a way, kind of a naturalized citizen, because we think of them as being around in the wild as well as the birds that are released for hunting purposes. So they will reproduce. Around my place in the town of Oregon, we have an individual who does work with one of the big conservation groups. I think it's Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, and he's been raising and releasing bobwhite quail. And they've made a bit of a stand on my 12 acres, and I just saw a couple the other day. So some of them made it through the winter, and the cockbirds will start calling soon, which is another call I really like to hear in the spring. Anyway, we're hoping that they will catch on and also start to reproduce. But we're on the northern edge of the range for bobwhite quail, so they have a tough go of it. But nevertheless, they will reproduce in the wild, and that's how they were successfully introduced to this landscape. So
there you go.
Congratulations on the gobbling. That was
that was pretty darn good.
I'm going to try that in the car on the way home, but not here.
Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Clara Neipert, by the way, is our producer. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today as we look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you join in. You can call us at 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. You know, all this talk about turkeys gobbling and the other bird songs. Spring's here. It's one of the fun times of the year for me, the bird songs that you hear this time of the year. Lots of fun.
Year, and there are just a lot of natural events going on out there that you don't have to be a turkey hunter out in the spring to enjoy these or intentionally ride around in the countryside looking and listening for some of these things. The turkeys gobbling, one thing. I saw Big Tom on the way over to the studio today. He was out in the field strutting around and probably gobbling, although I didn't hear him. So there's turkeys gobbling. The pheasants are crowing. I've got one rooster that made it through the winter in the backyard, and he, much like Chris's turkey, that rooster's been around now for 6 months, and he's crowing like crazy. I don't think there's a hen for miles around, but we're hopeful. And the other caller mentioned the woodcock breeding display.
Yeah.
All that stuff's going on, plus all the songbirds. The cardinals have been singing now for the better part of a month.
Yeah.
The redwings are going to start calling, and then all the songbirds will be back. So not only there are all sorts of sounds and breeding activities, but all these birds coming back, like the waterfowl, the ducks moving through now, are in their finest breeding plumage.
They're
beautiful. This is the time of year when they're all dressed up for the breeding season. So waterfowl that are in our flooded fields are fun to just go out and watch and see if you can identify 10 or a dozen species while you're out. And when the songbirds start coming back, the insect-eating songbirds here in another couple of weeks, you know, they're all in their spring finest too. Somehow, without even noticing it, my goldfinches at the feeder went from dingy little green things. Now all of a sudden they look like the wild canaries they're often called. So it happens quickly, and it's a time period that doesn't last long before the leaves come out and the bugs come out, and it's not as much fun to be outside. So
get out there and take advantage.
Get out and enjoy this stuff.
Jason in Mesa Mania, it's your turn. Hi, Jason.
Hey, thanks, Larry. I keep seeing what looks like a fisher along Black Earth Creek, but it seems like it's too small. It's more like the size of a muskrat, maybe a couple of feet. So, but I can't think what else it could be. So, I'm just wondering if that makes sense.
I think the odds are pretty good that it's a mink.
Mink.
I mean, if it were bigger than that, an otter would have the same general appearance, but an otter is at least the size of a fisher, a little sleeker looking, but also a large animal. Mm-hmm. But the way you described it, muskrat size, but elongated, kind of either a chocolate brown or mahogany brown, relatively short tail, that would be a mink.
Yeah, almost. It has to be.
I think that's anything else. Now, having said that, though, Jason, fishers have been seen in the area. There are good pictures of fisher in Columbia County and a couple in other areas around here. So Larry and I learned a long time ago in the program, you never say never about anything when it comes to wild animals, but
but they lope differently from a mink.
Yeah, they move differently, and their tail is longer and bushier, and they're more likely to be seen in a tree than creeping along the creek. So I think what you saw is a mink, but who knows?
We're pretty 99.9% sure, though.
Yes.
There you go, Jason. Thanks. David in Baraboo, your turn. Hi, David.
Hi. Yeah, I was bow hunting on the ground last year, and I saw something and heard something that I've never heard described before. I heard kind of a clumping sound coming from behind me, and probably 10 feet away, a doe came slowly walking by, and maybe, I don't know, 10 feet behind her was a buck. And each time his forefoot came down on the ground, it would clump. It was like an exaggerated thing.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I moved, so I never got a shot, but he stopped dead, and I thought maybe he was lame. after, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes of him not moving and me not moving, he finally left and he just walked away.
Yeah.
Yeah, that foot stomping is a fairly common thing with both species, actually, when they're nervous or disturbed or excited, as that buck probably was, especially if it was during the rut. But they almost walk stiff-legged, and it's a very noticeable thumping sound. So what you described is exactly what it was, and you were right there to see it, but it's not that unusual.
No, it isn't. I've heard it. I'm sure you've heard it too, Scott. Yeah. David, there you go. Thank you. Michael in Hillsboro, your turn. Hi, Michael.
Well, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I always try to tune in when Scott's on. I grew up in the Hillsboro area, and I had the opportunity in my youth to grouse hunt in parts of Vernon, Sauk, Richland, Monroe County, around Hillsboro.
Mm-hmm.
I've not seen nor heard a grouse in any of those areas for years. What can you tell me about the decline of the grouse population?
Well, I mean, you're not alone, Mike. When I came out to Wisconsin from New England for graduate school in the 1970s, most of the grad students hunted, and we spent lots of time roaming around southwestern Wisconsin, particularly in Iowa County and out along the Wisconsin River. And we had terrific grouse hunting. You know, we'd have afternoons with 30 flushes and think mm-hmm. nothing of that. And since those days, I continued deer hunting on the same big farm in Iowa County where we had found and shot many grouse in years gone by. And like you, I've not seen or heard, maybe with a couple of exceptions, a grouse in that country for decades, literally. They're virtually gone. And the reasons behind that, which were multiple, deal primarily with habitat maturation and the way the land's being used and the human footprint on the landscape. And if you really want to dig into it, there was a fellow who worked, first of all, he was with UW-Richland Center, that campus, and that's when he did some research on grouse in southwestern Wisconsin with his students, and then went on to head the Upland Bird Program for the DNR. And God, I'm not sure where Scott is right now, but his name is Scott Walter. And I think if you probably get on either the DNR website or just in general Google Scott Walter and grouse, you'll find his research papers that lay out very eloquently and elegantly what happened to grouse in southwestern Wisconsin. And it happened. There's no question about it. They're probably not coming back anytime soon because we're not going to put the landscape back in the circumstances they need. So
it wasn't the fault of the turkeys being introduced either.
No, that was early on. That was one of the stories. Oh, the DNR introduced turkeys, and the turkeys are eating grouse and grouse eggs. And there was no basis for that at all. But Scott was able, through his research and radio marked grouse and so forth, was able to very, very clearly lay out what happened to those birds, and they are in fact all but gone. So, unfortunately, that's the way it went, Mike. But on the other hand, the landscape out there is full of turkeys, and that wasn't the case when I was out there. Yeah. When I was out there grouse hunting, so things change over time, and if you're an outdoor user, you adapt to those changes and take advantage of what's available.
Yeah, Michael, thank you so much. Dot in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, Dot.
Hello. I was wondering, what type of trees do turkeys sleep at night? Mm-hmm. And do they take a tree for the season, or do they switch trees every week or every month? And what type of trees do they sleep in?
Well, the first part of your question we can handle pretty well. The part about how long they're going to be there, whether they switch around, is a little dependent on a whole host of things, including the turkey's preference and the weather. We'll get to that in just a second. But in terms of roost trees here in southern Wisconsin, primarily big oaks.
Yep.
Big open oaks, but they also like big white pines where you can find them. They're just not that common down here. But generally, it's large trees, older trees with the closer to horizontal branches You know, obviously a branch that comes off the tree at a 45-degree angle is not going to be a comfortable spot for a big bird like that to sit. But these big spreading oaks that have stretches of their limbs that are virtually flat or parallel to the ground, that's what they'll fly up to and then just simply stand there on the roost, and that's how they'll spend the night. And usually there'll be quite a few of them, some in the same tree, but certainly in maybe a group of three or four trees around. So when the leaves are off, if you happen to see a roost, you see these big lumps up in the tree. And what the heck are those? Well, they're turkeys. And that's something a turkey hunter likes to be able to see when they get into the woods in the dark. And then as it's getting light, oh, my gosh, I got lucky. There they are on the roost. And then they try and call them down so they can get a gobbler up close. So those are the – realistically, if they find a tree with the right form and location that they're looking for, they'd probably roost in any species. But oaks and big pines tend to provide more often those nice big horizontal limbs that I think they find pretty comfortable. In terms of which oak or pine or whatever, that depends a little bit on the location. In terms of the prevailing wind, they like to be up near the top of a ridge rather than down low. They like to have a bit of a viewscape so they can fly down and know where they're going. And they like to be out of the wind and weather. So those factors considered and the fact that they change a little bit might determine where they are on any given night. And if they're disturbed repeatedly on a roost, they'll just go to other trees.
Yeah.
So
I can remember going into a wooded area where I was sure there were some turkeys. It was dark, pitch dark, and I got down, sat down under a tree, and then just as the light was starting to come, about one, which was right in the tree above me, and I didn't know it, and about a half a dozen others, they all decided to come down at about the same time, and the noise they make with their wings.
Yep.
Was just like they certainly got my attention. They're really, the flapping wings are really make quite a noise.
Yeah, and I guess I'd just mention again, since a lot of people have brought up turkeys, they're big, they're reasonably conspicuous, and they're spectacular, especially the toms in the spring. They're rather colorful, especially their non-feathered parts, head and so forth. It can turn white, blue, red, or any combination thereof. And when they're displaying and their feathers are fanned out, they're very iridescent. The tail fan itself is pretty spectacular. And the things they do in terms of roosting and calling and chasing each other around and whatnot are pretty interesting. And anybody who's fascinated by this can find a spot where you can get out and watch. And
You don't have to be a hunter.
You can, and in fact, if you see a bunch of turkeys, and I suspect if you approach the landowner and said, yeah, I'd like to go out there and hunt turkeys, you might get a no because, you know, my cousin's coming out to hunt or whatever. But if you went up and said, gee, I'd like to go out and sit along your fence line there or at the base of the woods on the ridge and just take some pictures or listen or watch, I'd be real surprised if anybody turned you down. So it's another something to do on a nice spring day. And I hear next week it might be 70.
Yeah.
That would be good.
Dot, thank you so much for calling. I remember the story Bob Cooney, my old buddy, talked to me about with turkeys and deer. He was turkey hunting, and the turkey, it was down in the valley, and there were some turkeys and some deer, and one of the turkeys would kind of chase after a young deer. And then the deer would run away a little bit, but then it would turn around and run after the turkey, and he had more fun just watching those two chasing back and forth with each other. It was kind of a sight that you're never going to forget, that's for sure.
Well, and that's really one of the attractions of turkey hunting. In addition to hunting and maybe getting a turkey, you're out there early in the morning, fully camouflaged, quiet, concealed, and you get a chance to see everything that's going on. Everything that's
fox,
going on.
Deer, everything might come by.
I was sitting up against a tree a number of years ago and calling and watching for turkeys, and all of a sudden I was sitting there and splat! oh, right on the side of my face. What the heck is that? And I reached up. It was a big tree frog that had been on the tree and viewed me as part of the tree. And whomp, he leaped over and was stuck to the side of my face. So you just get to see all sorts of interesting things. So anyway.
There you go. You could join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Gary in Amherst emailed. He would like to know, previously, what term did you call dead trees left for habitat? Like a snag? Or
probably
what?
Snags. Snag, I mean, there are in the forestry context, they sometimes call them, if they're doing a timber harvest, they call them reserve trees. You know, they might see a big tree, for example, that, holy cow, the eagles have had a nest in there for whatever. And in that case, they'd probably have to leave a buffer around the nest tree. But trees that were obviously used for nesting, roosting, were very good acorn producers, whatever, can be left as reserve trees and kind of taken out of the harvest regime. That's a habitat management technique. But leaving trees that are dead, or you can make them dead by girdling them, that are suitable for snag formation, lots and lots of critters, both birds and mammals, will use a dead tree or snag for denning, roosting, feeding, and a host of other things. And then, of course, when that stuff's on the ground, it's called coarse woody debris in the habitat context. But that term has kind of fallen out of favor because, of course, the abbreviation is CWD, and that has another context in terms of wildlife right now. But I suspect that he's talking about either snag or reserve tree.
Yeah.
Den tree. There could be a variety of.
Wayne in Columbia County wondered why there are so few muskrat houses this past year. He says there weren't any muskrat houses in the normal places he checks. Who knows on that one, huh?
Yeah, I don't know what to say about that one. You know, local populations change. You know, the mink get into a marsh and kind of clean up on the muskrats, or the water level's wrong, or somebody trapped it heavily, or the ice was just too thick or froze to the bottom, and essentially the rats leave under those circumstances. No telling.
Rich called in, couldn't stay with us. He's been watching the Minnesota DNR Eagle Cam and wondered if you've been watching. He says their nest fell out of the tree, and a baby eagle was killed.
Hmm.
And how it would fall out of a tree, there must have been some hellacious wind or something.
Yeah, or one of the support, more likely one of the support branches or something gave way. But some of those eagle nests have been in the same tree for decades.
Yeah.
And they may weigh a ton or more.
Yes.
So, but we've had some pretty ferocious storms, too, so that's unfortunate. I hadn't
heard
that.
Maybe a combination of a ferocious storm and a weak limb holding up the nest.
That's too bad, though, but I mean, since it was mentioned, that eagle cam, and there are lots of other. If you do a little looking around, you can find all sorts of live camera feeds to watch events. There have been a lot of articles the last few days about the sturgeon spawning up on the Wolf and the rivers around the Lake Winnebago system and the upstream lakes, and that's a popular tourist thing to see in the spring as well. And I think there are some camera feeds on that activity as well. But if you look around a little bit on the internet, you'll find all sorts of stuff to watch.
The bear in, where's the cam in Canada where the bear are taking salmon?
Oh, yep.
I can't think of the name of it now. Somebody will call in and tell me, or shoot me an email and tell me, but that one is fantastic to watch too. Mark in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how's it going? Yeah, this notion that turkeys didn't affect rough grouse populations is just total whack. I mean, the guy who's the head of the Indiana Rough Grouse Society has many videos where hen turkeys wipe out whole grouse clutches. The turkeys came, the grouse disappeared. There's many other factors. The grouse population boomed when the elms died. Now we'll see if they come back after the ash die.
Hmm. Well, we'll see.
We'll see.
I just point out as a bit of a counter to that turkeys have done extraordinarily well in the extreme northern counties of Wisconsin, even with the snow and relative lack of the food resources the southern part of the state have had, but that's still our stronghold for rough grouse. And, Okay.
Brad in Platt, in Belleville, I'm sorry. Brad, hello.
Hello?
Hi, what's on your mind, Brad?
Well, a quick question about wild turkeys and their predation on ground nesting birds. We live out here in the southwest corner of Dane County. Been here 25 years. There used to be grouse and bobolinks, whippoorwills, meadowlarks, quail, and all sorts of the small ground nesting sparrows. They're gone. I haven't seen, and pheasants, we used to have pheasants. I haven't seen any of these birds, and I've been paying attention the last few years because one of the DNR people told me that turkeys predate ground nesting birds, chicks and eggs.
Well, the reality is a turkey's a bigger bird than anything we're talking about here, and they're also somewhat opportunistic. I mean, they'll eat what they can find, certainly grains and nuts and so forth, but also small snakes and frogs and whatever. And, you know, maybe given the opportunity, if they stumble across a, who knows, a thrush nest on the ground or whatever, they may take the eggs. But most of the species that Brad mentioned, especially things like bobolinks and whatnot that are grassland birds, or the grouse, which we just talked about a while ago in terms of have left for other reasons, have all not flourished primarily because of habitat change and weather conditions. Because, you know, there were a fair number of pheasants around until a few winters back. You get a late ice storm in May or whatever, and a lot of these birds suffer. So I'm not going to say that turkeys won't occasionally grab something that presents itself, but in general, the birds that have suffered and disappeared didn't disappear because of turkeys.
It was habitat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jane in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Jane.
Hi. This is my question. In February of 2022, I was driving west from Waukesha to Madison on I-94, when a red-tailed hawk slid across the hood of my car, and it happened so fast, I had no time to react. I don't know what happened to it. I had to keep my eyes on the road. And my question is, does this happen very often?
On that stretch of road, it happens a lot, Jane.
Well, Jane, I mean, you've touched on an important thing, and that is that highway mortality for all sorts of species. A speeding car, and I don't mean speeding illegally. I mean just a car that's doing 70 miles an hour where that's legal. These animals can't judge that kind of speed, and they're crossing the road for multiple reasons. And the carnage on our highways is really unfortunate, and it happens. And especially with raptors, hawks and owls and so forth, where they're either coming down on the roadway because there's some prey there, if they're acting as scavengers and see something, hey, I can pick that up and make off with it for dinner. They're swooping down from a tree to pick something up or grab a ground squirrel or whatever that's along the side of the road. And again, here comes the car and wham, they're hit. So it's not uncommon to see those birds mixed in amongst the roadkill on our highways. The fact that that bird was probably, it may have just been trying to get across the road, it may have been diving on something, and if it slid across the hood of your car and wasn't actually impacted, if there was no big thump and a cloud of feathers, it may have just kept right on going. So maybe that one was lucky, but a lot of them aren't.
Yeah.
And this...
Well, on that stretch of road, I can't remember a time driving that stretch of road when I didn't see a red-tailed hawk along the highway.
Well, it's a common spot for them because they can sit in a tree and watch that whole open space, including the median, where there are lots of rodents and so forth that they feed on. So it's a catch-22 for them. It looks like an attractive environment for them to find prey, but they run the risk of highway mortality. So it happens.
There you go, Jane. Thank you so much for calling. Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, Emeritus Wildlife Ecologist Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today. Ellie in Madison, he sent us a warning, and it's probably a good one because we've been telling people to get outside. She says, in southern Wisconsin, at least, the ticks are out. She says she got her first tick of the year a week ago, a deer tick crawling on her shirt. And, of course, tick-borne diseases are no fun. Something to remember.
Yeah, we've been picking them off the dogs now. Fortunately, the yellow labs, the tick shows up pretty well. So we've been seeing a few, but that's one of the, along with the mud and the mosquitoes and blackberry bushes, assorted other things, the woods is, it's not like a park. If you get out there, you should be aware of the issues and the risks.
I have, my clothing is... it's built into the clothing itself is a, I would say insecticide is the right term for it, that kills ticks and lasts quite a long time. So I use that. Jay in Washburn, question. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a quick question about porcupines, and we've been seeing a fair bit of sign in the way of stripped bark in some of our trees. And I'm wondering when they have their young in the spring so I can know when to keep my dog in the house a little bit more.
Yeah.
Well.
Trying to remember.
I'm just trying to figure out how to answer the question because it's a very slow progression of spring in the North Woods right now.
Yeah. I mean,
there's a lot of snow and ice up there, and unless it gets really warm really fast, things are going to be a little slowed down. But, of course, the birth of these animals is programmed by their gestation period and when they bred last year. Porcupines, although they're rodents, are a little unique among animals giving birth in that there's one or two at best, and they have a very long gestation period. But most of these animals, mammals, their births are timed to coincide with spring green-up. So, I mean, we're probably talking, if you had to pick a month that things peak out, and that's why the DNR is beginning to promote keep wildlife wild this time of year, but it would probably be May. But things start out now. As we know, the eaglets have hatched. Owls, horned owls, have probably hatched.
Yeah.
The first brood of ducklings turned up at the Humane Society last week, and I'm guessing the listeners have probably, somebody's probably seen a gosling already. So some things are either hatching or being born already, although they may still be in a den. And then that'll progress through May, and then there's a few late nesting songbirds, and of course the peak of fawn drop for the deer is in early June. So it's kind of a progression from March and April, peaks in May, and then some animals still emerging or giving birth into early summer. So the porcupines fit in there somewhere, but I guess since they're active all year in terms of some advice for Jay. I mean, I think you really need to be alert for porcupines out at any time of the year. And the little pups, porcupettes, I guess they're something. Anyway, are probably not the threat. They're born with quills. That isn't the issue. But they're probably not the threat to the dogs that the adults are. And they could be out at just about any time. So, yeah.
There you go, Jay. Thanks. Paula in Madison, your turn. Hi, Paula.
Hi. The other day I thought I heard a loon call, and I just was curious as to if, you know, I didn't see anything. So somewhere I heard that they have, like, brown feathers when they migrate back up north, and I'm just curious about that.
Did you say brown feathers?
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Well,
but I don't know if that's right.
The plumage varies a little bit with young loons, but in the spring, with the loons returning, especially the adults, I mean, they're in full black and white breeding plumage. And they may call as they're flying by, But I'm certain that with the Madison Lakes open, for example, if we we looked off the upper floor of the building here out over Lake Monona, there's probably some loons out there
right now. Seeing 50 or 60.
And they pile in there pretty good, and then they kind of hang up here as things begin to progress with the melt northward until they can get back on the northern lakes, and that isn't going to be for a while. So actually, this may be a really good year for viewing loons here in southern Wisconsin because they've got no place to go.
Yeah, that's right.
But you certainly could have heard a loon, Paula. That's not the issue. But the brown feather issue is not something that I think you should be watching out for.
Yeah.
Well, my son thought he saw, you know, the black and white, but I didn't see it. So not I'd heard that before. So, but thank you. That really clarifies it.
Okay. Good luck.
I think Trina's got a loon call for us. You got one? Oh, she doesn't have one. I'm sorry.
I think I've heard you yodel like a loon, Larry.
I love the call. So we'll find one, and she'll have one before the end of the show. We got to hear one loon call.
It's one of the great sounds of the North Woods.
Yeah, it is indeed. Erica in Manitowish Waters, your turn. Hi, Erica.
Good morning. Well, just barely morning. I just wanted to comment. I saw just the other day, right north of Mercer, I saw a rough grouse out looking for love with his rough out. And he was all decked out. So that was cool.
That's great.
And you don't see that just every day.
No.
And about probably 10 years ago on Mother's Day, my golden retriever tried to eat a baby porcupine, and it wasn't pretty.
Oh, no, I can't imagine.
When they're born, their quills are
yep.
Within 10 minutes, I think they're sharp as a sewing needle, and my God, what a mess.
Yeah.
And what a vet bill. He had them all down his throat.
Oh, geez. So. Yeah, a few stuck in the muzzle is one thing that maybe you can deal with a needle-nose plier, but a mouthful of quills is something that requires professional care. That's unfortunate.
Thanks, Eric. Appreciate the call. Keith emailed us. He was fishing on Black Creek, and two mink were mating and chasing each other up and down both sides of the creek, paying no attention to him. They ran in front of Keith a few times, and one actually ran over his foot. It was a little disconcerting being so close. His mind jumped, "Don't crawl up my leg," and he stepped back.
Well, this is true of deer during the rut or mink or anything else during the mating season. The mating season kind of preoccupies these animals when it comes around, and it's a good time to get some observations up close when they're paying attention to other things. You can sometimes, especially with mink or other members of the weasel family, if they're close to you, you can squeak them. And I may have been walking to the studio for all I remember, but I was walking along the lakeshore path here. along the gravel path along Lake Mendota,
yeah.
And I saw a family of mink in the rock rubble there, a riprap, and I stopped, and there was nobody around, and I squeaked. You suck on the back of your hand, give them that squeaking sound, and many weasels will respond to that. They think, oh, it's a mouse or an injured rabbit or something. Anyway, I squeaked a few times, and pretty soon I had a baby mink on the end of each shoe standing up, looking up at me, saying, what the heck is that? And the other ones milled around, and then eventually we both went about our business. But anyway, those kinds of things are memories of interactions with wildlife that you remember for a long time. And if you get out and do a few things and learn a few tricks of the trade, you can improve your opportunity to experience such things.
And Bruce emailed, they kept hearing a noise under their deck in eastern Marathon County last summer. They live in a marshy area. They recorded the sound, brought it to the local DNR office. They thought it was a raccoon. They didn't see any other evidence of raccoons, but the sound is also similar to an eastern African tree frog. Bruce wonders, could such an animal live in Marathon County? An Eastern African tree frog?
Well, I'm not familiar with that tree frog, but fortunately, well, I'd say that many of these invasive species that are either extending their range or introduced perish during our Wisconsin winters. So that's one of the few good things I'd like to say about a Wisconsin winter right now, because I'm tired of this one. But not knowing the Eastern African tree frog, I'd say it would have a tough go of it in Marathon County.
Yeah,
in the winter. So probably not something to worry about. But when it comes to sounds, especially animals in a den, there's no holds barred. I mean, you may not be able to find a recording, because raccoons, the porcupines we talked about, and other animals, especially the young ones, can make sounds that you just can't imagine are coming from that animal. And twice with porcupines, out once in a campground and once with a group of 4-H kids doing a night hike, we were hiking along on Black Hawk Island in the Wisconsin River, and all of a sudden there was this god-awful screeching and screaming. We thought, somebody's being tortured over there, and says, let's go see. And we finally got over there, and it was a couple porcupines up in a tree, and the screeching was awful. And anyway, I guess we're running up on the noon hour here, but we'll tell the other porcupine story later.
We'll do that. Scott Craven, our guest today, emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Scott. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, emeritus wildlife ecologist from UW-Madison and UW Extension. Great to have Scott back. And certainly if you have questions, give a call at 800-642-1234, or maybe you got a story you want to tell. Number to call, again, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And Scott, before we go to the phones or emails, there are a lot of events and activities going on this time of year, and throughout the year, actually.
Well, there are just a lot of things, like you say, going on that I think our listeners might might be aware of, but need to act fast if they want to get in on some things. For example, this week is Keep Wildlife Wild Week that the DNR is sponsoring, and they have a website up with information for people on what to do for or with orphaned baby animals. And we've talked about this for years on the program, and it's that time of year coming up, and here's an opportunity for people to learn what the proper response is. But fundamentally, the answer remains the same. Those animals are better off where they are unless you can obviously determine that, hey, mother duck just got run over by a car, and here the ducklings are gathered up in the gutter. Action is then warranted. And anyway, there's information available on that website to help out with that kind of thing. I understand a few programs back you talked about the upcoming field trip litany for the Natural Resources Foundation.
Yeah.
Over 250 trips all over the state with reptiles, amphibians, natural areas, all kinds of neat stuff. If you've never participated in these trips, go to NRF, the website, and find out how you can register and which trips are still available. There's a lot of cool ones. Also going on right now are the open houses around the state, held Monday and Tuesday night, but there are still a few this week, open houses for the upcoming Conservation Congress spring hearings, which used to be big, popular face-to-face meetings where they vote on a variety of proposals put forward by the Natural Resources Board or the Congress itself or by individuals. But for some reason, the voting is still next week, starting on the 10th, I believe, and it's still going to be virtual. I'm not sure why, but they are offering these open houses in every county for a chance to hear about the proposals from DNR staff, and they're voting for Congress delegates at the open houses. So in a way, we're trying to get the people to do two different things through what used to be accomplished in one fell swoop. So I'm not sure what the rationale is, but there are some interesting proposals up. If you want to vote for your Congress delegates, get out tonight or the next night or two while the open houses are going on. But be ready to vote virtually starting, I think, on Monday. You know, there are things like expanding the youth deer hunt by a couple of days and other things that I think some people have pretty strong feelings about. So vote. Mm. Also, coming up on the 23rd of the month. No, is it the 23rd? Let me see. No, it's the 25th. Tuesday the 25th is the 2023 induction ceremony for the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame. That, too, will be virtual, but that means many more people can participate. And you can go to the Hall of Fame website and find out what the registration procedure is and tune in the online inductions of Byron Shaw, a water quality guy from UW-Stevens Point, Michael Dombeck in the forestry side, and Mark and Sue Martin, who on the wildlife side are very well known from managing the Audubon Society's Goose Pond Sanctuary for years and lots of DNR activities in natural areas. And then finally, I guess the only other thing I'd mention is that this is a good news, bad news situation. The bad news is it's tax season, but the good news is this is yet another chance, the annual opportunity to contribute to the Endangered Resources Fund, Endangered Species Resources Fund, on the tax form with the little loon logo that's on your tax form. And
I do that every year.
They've raised millions to support natural areas management, state scientific areas, all kinds of endangered and threatened species of every taxa you can imagine, both plants and animals. It's a worthwhile thing to do. So think about that as you're filing your taxes. And I guess that's it for the hit list. Since we talked so much about turkeys, I think there are still some leftover turkey permits available for the later harvest permits if you missed out on that and still would like to go turkey hunting. So there you have it.
There we have it. A listener emailed, back to porcupines for a minute. They'd never seen a porcupine, and they want to see a porcupine. They're in Washington County and spend time in Dane County, too. What are the chances and where do they look? They've got deer, turkeys, fox, coyote, and other small animals, but they've never seen a porky.
Well,
that's a hard one.
The best chances are actually see one along the road. They're not fleet of foot.
No.
So if you see one, they're moving slowly from point A to point B, and if you see one crossing the road, which is why they often end up in the roadkill array, because they are so slow moving. But if you want to see a live one, just be alert while you're traveling around. Maybe the best way, I think, in terms of, we've been always trying to show our students at our summer field course a porky, but the way you home in on them is actually their dens are pretty conspicuous, usually in a hollow tree. And at the base of the tree, there'll just be a pile, like maybe a bushel basket full of droppings, which look like oversized fibrous deer pellets. Mm-hmm. And that's a giveaway that's a porcupine den. And then if you kind of scope it out or set up a little blind so you can watch, you've got a much better probability to see one. But most encounters are by chance. And so get around where they are and keep your fingers crossed.
And you can join in, too. If you have a question or comment, the number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Mary in Oconee County had emailed us yesterday. She had the opportunity to witness two female turkeys fighting. They have a handful that came through to check out their bird feeder. The two males are quite handsome and strutting for the ladies. Anyway, she was on the other side of the house and suddenly heard a racket like she's never heard before. And two females were fighting and appeared to be fighting to the death. She's never seen or heard such a thing. It was a new group of females that showed up. Sure was something. So I'm wondering if it was a new group and the old group didn't like the new group.
The group that was probably using the feeder was a little protective of that food resource, and a squabble broke out. I doubt that they would have fought to the death, but it may certainly have appeared that way with lots of thrashing wings. The fights that can be ferocious are actually with the toms, and they have those big spurs on their on their legs that they use as a weapon. But a turkey wing is a pretty substantial piece of nature architecture, and if the hens are whacking each other with those wings, I'm sure it looked like quite a fight.
Mark in Wisconsin Dells will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Mark. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. I've had a little conundrum lately with a bird that is a falcon-like bird flying alongside my car sometimes when I'm driving down country roads. And so I get quite a few seconds to look at it pretty close. And it's got me stymied. It's bigger than a pigeon, smaller than a red-tailed hawk, falcon-like for sure, but it's white all over, up and down, except for its black wingtips. And my Peterson guide, the best I can come up with, is a white hawk, unless it's some kind of gyre falcon. But, you know, the white hawks aren't supposed to be up here. They're supposed to be down on the Gulf of Mexico. So I'm not sure. I wonder if anybody's seen that kind of bird or what, any white hawks in our area. I'm around Reedsburg where I've been seeing it.
Well, Mark, you've extended the conundrum to two other people right now because
yeah.
Larry's pondering and so am I. You know, the birds you described are not found in this area. When you started out by saying it was falcon-like and relatively small, I was thinking kestrel, or otherwise in the old days known as a sparrowhawk or a sharp-shinned hawk, which
yeah,
would have fit
what
the bill.
I thought.
But when you went larger than a pigeon and hawk-like, then we're into the Cooper's hawk size range, and they can be, you know, they can be a little, especially around a nest. They're known for being aggressive to people passing by, just walking near the nest or riding a bike near the nest. But it's a little early for that, and they're not white. Now, that's not to say that virtually any animal can be leucistic or albinistic and you get a white appearance, but if it's got black wingtips, it's not an albino. And you say it follows along by your car, so you've seen it in different places.
Yeah, not necessarily the same bird, just that when I see it, a lot of times it's about the level of my car, maybe a little higher, but just going down the road parallel with me. And it's not really following my car.
Yeah, it's just flying along the road.
Yeah. So, you know, sort of like a marsh hawk. But I keep looking at the books, and I come up with, well, you know, gyre falcons, but they're not all white.
No, and they're not. They're not found anywhere around here either.
There could be, I mean, one explanation could be, you know, we've had these high winds across the country. It's possible somebody got out of place.
Well, it's always possible that something really weird gets blown off course in a storm or whatnot and shows up. But yeah, how long a period have you been seeing it, Mark?
Months, you know.
A month or so.
I deliver papers every day. And I do a long day on Tuesday, like today I'm still delivering. Often I can't call in because I'm in a bad place.
Yeah.
For signal, you know. But so I see a lot of different wildlife. But I've been seeing this type of bird, I think, in a few different places. But generally there may be woodlots or wooded areas, but when I see it, it's sort of on an open field where I can get a clear view, not too far from my car. And it's just got me stymied, you know, because it's a beautiful bird. I mean, it's very great.
But sure. you think it's possible you may have seen more than one of them then?
Oh, yeah, I think so. And it's always, like I say, it's as far as I can see, white on the top and the bottom. And just the black wingtips, like one of these seagulls is like that, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I guess this is one of those cases where, as I say, you've extended the conundrum, but we've got lots of listeners out there who are superb birders and can maybe offer up some suggestions. I mean, I can think of white birds with black wingtips, but none of which should really be around here. And you mentioned gulls, or of course, there'll be lots of those around during the migration. And one of those could certainly, or a tern, for example, could certainly fit the bill, but shouldn't really be flying around in the habitat you're describing. So I don't know what to tell you. We'll see if anybody calls in with a suggestion, but you know, if you see it repeatedly or have some idea where it is, if you could get a picture, that's you know, with your phone or whatnot, grab even a poor quality picture would maybe give us some clues.
Yeah, sorry, Mark. I wish we had more. A picture would help. That's for sure. Well, Scott, I did want to mention that there's a new book out that we're going to be talking about on the show, and it's from a friend, you know, a guy you know pretty well. It's called It's called Wrong Tree.
Wrong Tree, right.
By Jeff Wilson?
Yep. Yeah, it's written by Jeff Wilson, who was a longtime wildlife staff person with the DNR, primarily up around Mercer, and he lives in a cabin on the Turtle Flambeau Flowage. He's been there for years. And the book is really about his adventures, and maybe sometimes you could say misadventures, working in the wildlife arena in the North Woods. So it's replete with stories about interactions with loons, bears, eagles, you know, things that you'd expect in the North Woods. And I found it a fascinating read. I had reviewed a bit of it for him to write something for the dust cover. But then when I got a copy, I said, I'm going to see how these little stories go. And you can read it piecemeal because each section or story stands alone.
Yeah.
But together, they're his whole life experience in this particular work arena. And, I mean, I just found it fascinating to see some of the creative solutions to problems of capturing or handling or marking animals that not only he but the other folks in the office and across disciplines, the fire control people or the yeah. wardens or whatever, all pitched in to figure out these problems. And it's some really cool stuff, and it takes you back. My cabin isn't that far from the Turtle Flambeau, and it was kind of like, hey, this stuff's going on right in my backyard. It's a really cool read. So people interested in the out-of-doors and how we know some of the things we know about these creatures would really enjoy reading Wrong Tree.
Yeah.
And I won't tell you what the title Wrong Tree means. That's one of the stories. You'll have to figure that out on your own. But I guess you're thinking about maybe having them on the show.
He's going to be on the show. I'm not sure if we have a schedule, but hey, it'd be great to get a copy of the book and read it beforehand, because then you can ask some questions of him when he's on. But we'll certainly let you know when he appears on the show. Looking forward to that. And the Turtle Flambeau Flowage, I have a soft spot for that. Caught some pretty big muskie on that flowage, and some good, pretty nice walleye too. Once a very large walleye I caught on a muskie lure.
Huh.
So there you go. Chris and Stevens Point, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Larry. I was listening to the last caller, and I would suggest looking at a male marsh harrier with the black wing tips and almost white body.
Male marsh harrier. Oh, I think you've hit on something, Chris.
Yeah, could be marsh hawk, marsh harrier. I mean, just look that up in your bird books and see if it. Mark will have to make the determination if that's what it is, but it's certainly a possibility to check into. Thank you.
How's your gardening going? Getting ready for that spring gardening? We should talk a bit about that. I mentioned that we were going to talk about gardening with wildlife in mind, and we haven't done that.
Well, I have all my seeds, and I'm just waiting for onion plants to show up. That's usually the first thing I plant. I did plant a few onion sets in a planter yesterday just because I could, and it felt good to have my fingers in the soil, actually.
Yeah.
The main garden is too muddy to think about doing anything, but that'll be coming up soon, and I guess the relevance is severalfold. Number one, as people are thinking about gardens or gardening, they should also be planning to protect those gardens from various wildlife that like to share the resource. Early on, it's more problematic in the growing season because you're just waiting for that first spinach or lettuce, and then the woodchuck or rabbit gets it later on in the summer. Ah, who cares? There's tons of stuff out there. But I would go back to, hey, a good fence is the first line of defense.
And you've got a good fence.
I've got a good fence, and a fence helps, but there are certainly other issues of having and knowing how to use a live trap to remove some of the problem animals. Use the fence. Be aware of some repellents and other chemical solutions that will help a little bit, but maybe not solve a problem. But be ready for that as it comes up. The other aspect that I think right now is even more important is that you can actually do some of your gardening to benefit wildlife. Think about planting something for their benefit or a habitat feature. And I guess I would turn to my pond system, and this is, yeah. I mean, a water garden, basically. And
it's pretty cool, actually.
Something we've talked about for a while, but this one, I've built them in the past, but this one I had professional help with, and there's a kind of a three-tiered waterfall and a little stream course, and then the pond. And I was out working on it yesterday, and all through the winter, I keep a heater in it, so there's an open hole, and the stuff that visited that pond for water was pretty impressive. So you see a lot of things you wouldn't see otherwise. This morning there was a pair of mallards in the pond. They've been fun to watch the last week or two. The doves are using the water source regularly. Tracks would suggest the deer are there every night to get a drink. So you can provide some things that will really jazz up your backyard landscape, but also be very attractive wildlife features. And a water garden is one of them, but various fruit or nut-producing shrubbery. If you're going to plant something anyway, then ask the nursery people or read the catalogs to see something that has a good crop of something that animals can use, birds, mammals, or whatever can use as food, or that makes good nesting cover, or is a combination of things. It meets your landscaping needs, but it also meets some wildlife needs. So think about that, too, as you're planning your gardening.
Oak trees. They are the source of food for so many, and cover and everything else for so many.
Oaks are great. They grow painfully slowly.
Of course.
You have to realize when you're planting an oak sapling or seedling or putting an acorn in the ground that it's a long-term proposition. But if it's a property that's likely to remain in the family for a long time, or even if it isn't, you're still doing something to benefit wildlife. And I used to think, wow, this is a hopeless situation. But when we bought the property we're on and built the house, we were throwing walnuts around and various things, thinking, we'll see what happens. But now we've been in the house for 25 years, and some of those walnut trees are 30 or 40 feet tall. The pines and the buffer things we put in, there were 2-0 seedlings from the DNR nursery, are now 40 or 50 feet tall. So, you know, time does pass, and if you have a chance to watch these things, it's worth doing, and it's rewarding to see some of these things mature and provide the benefits you hoped they would. So
there you go.
Look into it a little bit. There are lots of good resources, books and internet resources to help you with planting for wildlife.
And on that note, Scott, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And you may even be back next month. Who knows? It's possible.
I've got to do a little juggling to accommodate a fishing trip in June.
Okay. Scott Graven, our guest emeritus, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Great to have him with us. He'll be back. We'll do it again. Tomorrow, representatives from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection return to answer your questions about scams, and there are apparently many of them. In the meantime, stay with us. What's in store? I'm Larry Meadler.